That's the New York Ska Jazz Ensemble with In Motion. It is from their 2011 album, Double Edge. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And we begin today by returning to the subject of what's going on in Haiti. We had updated you a couple of days ago. But we return now to get an idea of what's going on in Haiti. We're joined once again by our correspondent, and I say that with the greatest respect, Kim Ives, veteran journalist, prize-winning documentarian, and editor of the English edition of the newsweekly Haïti Liberté. And he joins us to give us an update on what's going on in Haiti. Well, since we last talked, things have gotten even more precarious. What's going on?
Well, thank you, Eutrice. And the situation has become very precarious. It appears the government prime minister, I should say, Jacques Guy Lafontaine, will probably be deposed. This seems to be what's in the cards. The demonstrations have been full force, basically beginning last Friday, even though there had been some demonstrations before, but the real mayhem began last Friday when the government announced a fuel price increase of up to 50% for various petroleum products used in Haiti, gasoline, diesel, and kerosene. Of course, Haiti relies a lot on kerosene for cooking and so forth. So that was the one that was hiked the most, 50%. So we end up having a perfect storm. What had happened was the government released the decree announcing these price increases on Friday during the match between Brazil and Belgium in the World Cup. And many, many Haitians are huge Brazil fans. They see Brazil as sort of the surrogate national team. And the government had sort of thought that Brazil would beat Belgium and there would be a celebration afterwards, and the outrage about the price hikes would be drowned out by that celebrating. But Brazil lost to Belgium, so people were angry, people were disappointed, and then they came out and they saw the new prices that were going to be going into effect the next day. So it was a double whammy, and they really did go ballistic. So, of course, it wasn't just the fuel prices. It's been months and months of squeezing of the people on every level. The budget started that Jovenel Moise came with started to tax them, and not just them, but even expatriate Haitians had to pay taxes. They had the government had blocked all investigation of the $3.8 billion that was squandered from the Petro-Caribe Fund, the Petro-Caribe Fund being a fund which is built with money from the sale of cheap Venezuelan petroleum products in Haiti. The Caravan for Change, which is sort of a traveling carnival that Jovenel Moise has been doing around the country, has spent millions of dollars on that. But while, you know, schools and hospitals are poverty stricken, local governments, they don't get any money. They're completely cash starved. But Jovenel finds millions to reestablish the traditionally repressive Haitian army last November. Meanwhile, the police have used very brutal and sometimes lethal violence in crushing demonstrations. The jails are filled with over capacity, with mostly unjudged detainees. So all these things, Utrice, built up to just create this tremendous frustration, and that has become somewhat the watchword of this mobilization. Most of them do have a watchword. It's "Nous bouquet." We are fed up. And so essentially, Monday and Tuesday were a general strike, which was 100% successful, it appears, throughout the country. Often it will be successful in some towns but not others, but this time it was successful everywhere. Yesterday afternoon, things started to sort of get back to normal. And as we can imagine, as usually is the case, the core group of ambassadors, basically the U.S., France, and Canada, with, you know, a number of other countries sprinkled in, Brazil, Spain, et cetera, for looks more. But they essentially said, you better respect constitutional order, meaning you better not overthrow Jovenel Moïse, because that is what demonstrators are demanding. It seems right now what's happening is a lot of the parliamentarians are saying, okay, we're going to have a confidence vote in the government, and they're pretty surely going to lose that. So it means the prime minister, again, for listeners who may not be familiar with Haiti's form, you have the president, who's the head of state, but then he appoints a prime minister who is the head of government. So the government of Prime Minister Jacques Lafontaine will probably fall and be replaced by somebody else. This has traditionally been what happened when Martelly faced a similar uprising back in 2015. That's what he did. He sacrificed his prime minister, Laurent Lamothe. So even though he'll give up a rook, he'll still have his queens and bishops and other chess pieces. So will the mobilization continue? Well, that's the big $64,000 question. Opposition is very weak right now and divided. This has been a wake-up call both to them and to the government that people's power is there lurking just beneath the surface. The situation remains extremely fragile and volatile. So we'll see what happens in the coming weeks, but I don't think the road is going to be easy ahead. Jovenel is only 17 months into his 60-month term, so is he going to make it to the end? I don't know. This is a pretty. This augurs badly for his future.
Well, that, in plain language, means that it might be the case that very soon he will be no more the president of the country. There were rumors that he had already left the country. Is that true?
Yes. No, there were a lot of rumors. And apparently, at that sort of peak of the mobilization, it had been said that he various feelers were put out to countries where he could end up going. Apparently, Ivory Coast and El Salvador agreed to receive him, and apparently there were discussions even in the U.S. State Department helping look for these feelers and making a contingency plan. But right now, the uprising of the past five. Of basically Friday through Tuesday has sort of spent a lot of its energy. I don't think it's over by any means. I think we are likely to see things flare up again. But absent an organizational infrastructure and force, political force that can articulate and make strategy and set a line of march for people, it may take time before people can actually achieve their goal, which is to force Jovenel Moïse to step down. But right now, he still is in power. And in fact, his communications minister, who has been very much a sort of lightning rod, gave his resignation yesterday, but he refused it. They said, no, you got to stay in your post. And so he retracted it. So they're definitely digging in their heels and going to try to stay. So we'll see what the people's response is to that. I think the blood is in the water, as they say, and I think that it's not going to be an easy road ahead.
Who or what is emerging as the political apparatus representing the people in all of this?
Well, you have the two traditional parties, there's the Lavalas movement, which emerged after the 1986 fall of Jean-Claude Duvalier, spawned a party after the election of Jean-Bertrand Aristide in 1990 called the Lavalas Family Party. And that party has sort of split into two parties now. There's the Lavalas Family Party and another party under the leadership of charismatic Senator Moïse Jean-Charles. But both those parties right now are somewhat compromised. The Lavalas Family Party has lost a lot of its, force, because back when there was an uprising in 2015 and Martelly was on the ropes, they said, no, let him finish his term. That alienated a lot of their base, who went over to the Petite Dessalines, Dessalines Children Party. But and Moïse Jean-Charles in particular, has made a number of extremely foolish alliances with right-wing figures who have basically betrayed him. And so people have lost a lot of faith in that party, too. So right now, those two Lavalas parties are somewhat weakened. There are a number of others in the Popular Democratic movement. There's a lawyer, Andre Michel, who is very outspoken and articulate, but has a lot of people who aren't happy with him because he did support the coup against Aristide in 2004. There are a number of other second level, but the real grassroots, I could say the left progressive parties have, of course, as is the case in this country, they don't have any backing. They don't have any money. It's very hard. They're there. They're working. They do things, but they don't come to the leadership yet. They are there. You have the MPDP. You have various grassroots organizations who are all there. It's very pregnant with change in this movement and potential, but they haven't yet gotten to the point where they can lead the masses, mostly due to lack of means. So, we'll see how things develop. Haiti Liberté is in touch with a lot of those forces, and in many ways ends up being a kind of a platform for them to put out their declarations and analysis. And, we hope in the coming months that we'll see the emergence of a really strong grassroots party or movement that can challenge and actually get power back from the electoral coup d'etat that put Jovenel Moïse in power.
So just to review, the intensity of the rebellion has slowed down a bit, but we're not seeing a clear picture yet of what is to be the alternative once it is hoped that things do calm down to the point where there are negotiations. The president is still president for the time being, although it appears as if it's as good a foregone conclusion that inevitably he will bow out or he will be forced out. And right now there's a kind of searching around, a kind of feeling around for just who the new group would be to take a leadership position in Haiti. And all of this is quite fluid right now. But most importantly, the intensity of the rebellion has ratcheted down quite a bit. There's an intervention of foreign powers trying to ameliorate the situation. And it's very, very fluid right now, but we expect at some point that the nitty-gritty will have to be dealt with, which is what's the immediate future for Haiti? In which direction will it go? And is it going to operate with a totally new government? Or is there something else that's going to take place? We don't know very much about which direction things are going to go.
Eutrice, one thing I would say is that more than likely, if history is any guide, what Jovenel will do is he'll try, if this government is kicked out by the parliament, which I kind of expect. I mean, it's possible they'll maintain it, but I because a lot of the parliament is basically of the right-wing current or cousins of it. So, you know, maybe they'll find a way to fudge it. But if the government falls, what Jovenel probably would do is try to lure, take some members from the opposition, such as it is, and integrate them in to, you know, give it a slightly more progressive color, if you will. But I don't think it will work. You know, the fundamental policies, the headlock that neoliberalism has on Haiti, basically squeezing the people, taxing them in the form of, you know, fuel hikes or, you know, cutting government payrolls, slashing hospital school budgets, which were already slashed to the bone. So basically you're cutting into bone. These things are going to continue short of a really revolutionary change in Haiti. So, you know, I expect there to be some kind of efforts to confuse people by taking a few people. And there's always people who will sell out who, you know, they're given a salary and a car and, you know, they'll say, oh, you know, maybe I can do something. Well, yeah, you're doing something. You're just helping disguise what is a anti-popular government. So probably that's what we're going to see in the coming weeks. But the volatility is there. The people are angry. They are really, really hungry and hurting, and they need change.
Well, thank you so much, Kim, for this update. We could always depend on you for some clarity in the middle of all this confusion. We can depend on you and the knowledge that you have of Haiti to give us at least a clear picture of what is going on. And I thank you so much for being available to us today.
Well, thank you, Yutrice, for making us available and for doing the work you do with Lead Stories.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Well, this Sunday, June the 15th, brings an end to one of the world's greatest sporting events, the FIFA World Cup, hosted by Russia at a cost of $14.2 billion. It is the most expensive World Cup ever, and the most successful and the most popular. It also has been one of the most political without us actually paying attention to that aspect of it. For the World Cup has been tinged by the impact of a subject that has been global in scope and in impact, and I'm talking about immigration. Just yesterday, I was talking with Gilbert Messier, filmmaker, co-founder of, and editor-in-chief of News Junkie Post, and author of The Orwellian Empire. But for the purposes of this conversation, it is important also to point out another credential he has that we don't talk about, and that is he's an avid World Cup fan. And in the course of our conversation, something popped up that was quite intriguing, and we haven't really considered this as part of the mix, and that is the impact of immigration. And to this end, how has immigration tinged the World Cup? And welcome, Gilbert, to Lead Stories today. It was a really fascinating aspect of the conversation we were having yesterday.
And Well, thank you very much. I was under the impression we were going to talk about the NATO summit, but this is a much funnier topic, and without the Trump confusion aspect of it. But anyway, as I mentioned to you yesterday, in France, after the qualification of France to the final, they were the Champs-Élysées and other places in France were completely full of people celebrating, playing the Marseillaise, even Cop Cruiser blasted the Marseillaise all over French town, and it was a celebration of a nationalism of some kind, but not the kind of the far right, because the French team happened to be, and for anybody that look at it, happened to be a celebration of what is France and what is more generally Western Europe, despite what the rising far right is saying about cultural identity and all this sort of like neo-white supremacy and racist nonsense, a complete melting pot. And I called it with you last night and made you laugh that it was, in my opinion, and I'm not the only one saying that, the best Afro-Euro team of the tournament, and this is precisely why, in my opinion again, they should win. And they are celebrated all over Africa, like the star player, his name is Mbappé, his father is from Cameroon, his mother is from Algeria, but all those players are really the essence of what is France, what is the post-colonial France. This immigration topic, which is, of course, dear to Trump and his mentor, you know, ideological mentor Steve Bannon, of like exclusion and manifested by the Northern League in Italy and also in Austria and Germany and the far right Front National in France. It doesn't correspond to the reality of of French people at large. They are very, very happy about what's going on. They don't feel like there's only about three Caucasians, ethnically Caucasian. All of them are French, of course, born in France, but three Caucasian, purely Caucasian in the French team among about 23 players. Now, this is kind of an interesting ratio, wouldn't you think? I mean, the rest is like from either Africa proper or North Africa. So this, to me, is the reality of things. And this is why this sort of wedge issue of immigration and what to do with those people, which, by the way, have only been victimized because of the policy of the West, including France, in West Africa, in North Africa, and most recently in Libya and Syria. We, as the West and the U.S. mainly, have created those problems, and it's justice that we are now facing the consequences of what we have created. We have created that misery that forced people to cross. We talked about this on your show, specifically about Libya, the horrendous journey of those people leaving, numerous parts of Africa, crossing through Libya and ending up in detention center, either in Italy, Greece, or sometimes France. This is horrible, and nobody should stay indifferent to it. And, France has 5 million people from North African origin and about 2 million from African origin. And the integration, despite what everybody is saying, is and should be even more of a success. Of course, those populations, there's an economical factor. Those populations usually... there's more unemployment, they're sort of exploited by the French, ruling class, but nonetheless, they feel French. They are French, and nobody can take that away from them. And I'll tell you, when if they do win, and it's likely they will be treated like Emmanuel Macron will give them all the Légion d'honneur, and so on and so on.
Well, it's an interesting note, just to say that in the middle of what ostensibly is athletics, we see a reflection of a very serious topic that at one point or the other has served to galvanize the people, divide the people, and basically raise the question of who qualifies and who does not qualify. But in the end, we see the complete contradiction to that, where people are able to set aside their natural prejudices once a very African team is leading them to victory. Now let's talk about NATO. President Trump, of course, is on his way. He's been on his way to the NATO summit. And even before he gets there, in typical Trumpian style, he's already started a fight. And the fight is not as legitimate as people would think. I mean, some of the coverage is saying that President Trump has a point about the NATO members basically not carrying their fair share of the burden of operating NATO, and that was to pitch in 2% of their gross domestic product to cover the cost of NATO operations. But this is a great distortion. That is not the case at all. In fact, I just want to take this short time to point out a little piece that was run by the Associated Press. And here's what it says. This is now the crux. It's addressing the crux of Trump's complaints. En route to a NATO summit, President Donald Trump is spreading the myth that members of the alliance owe money to the United States. His tweet Tuesday, "Many countries in NATO, which we are expected to defend, are not only short of their current commitment of 2%, which is low, but are also delinquent for many years in payments that have not been made. Will they reimburse the United States? Here are the facts. There is no such debt to the United States or to NATO. Therefore, there's no delinquency or question of payment. In 2014, before Trump was president, NATO members agreed to stop cutting their military budgets and set a goal of moving toward spending 2% of their gross domestic product on their own defense by 2024. It was not a commitment, not a direct contribution to NATO, not a payment owed to the United States, and not something the alliance members pledged to achieve immediately. Trump is right that most NATO members are spending less than 2% of their GDP on their defense budget, though more are moving in that direction. Trump has assailed NATO members, such as Germany, for lagging on their military budgets, while he has simultaneously taken credit for progress on that front. He has repeatedly claimed that because of his pressure, quote, billions and billions of dollars are pouring in, unquote, which is also not true, because there is no such fund for money to pour in. It is true that the U.S. is expected to defend fellow NATO members when they are threatened. It is equally the case that NATO partners are expected to defend the U.S. if threatened. The alliance operates under a mutual defense treaty. NATO does have a shared budget to which each member makes contributions based on the size of its economy. The United States, with the biggest economy, pays the biggest share, 22.1%. Four European members, Germany, France, Britain, and Italy, combined pay 43.8% of the total. The smaller countries pay smaller shares. The funds, totaling about $3 billion this year, are used to run NATO's headquarters and to pay certain other civilian and military costs. No member is known to be in arrears. That's a statement from the Associated Press. So we have on the world stage a president who is not only wrong, but stubbornly wrong, spreading wrong information and making up new rules, talking about NATO in a way in which it is in total contradiction to how NATO operates.
Look, Utrecht, President Trump and the rest of his new advisors, Mike Pompeo and John Bolton, lives in a complete alternate reality, and it's not only it's. The NATO summit actually started today, and it really marks a continuation of Trump's erratic and completely undiplomatic behavior. Remember in June, just like at the G7 meeting in Canada, Trump insulted Prime Minister Trudeau, and he already has said today a confrontational tone to the summit in Brussels. His opening salvo was towards Germany. Trump attacked Germany over defense spending, as you mentioned, the issue he has is defense spending, which is mainly false. It is true in the case of Germany that it is below the 2% benchmark, which is not part of the NATO charter, by the way, of GDP, that is set as a guideline only since 2014, as you mentioned, for the 29 NATO members. Today, Trump accused Germany of being totally controlled by Russia and even captive to Russia. This is what he said, I'm quoting, over the country purchase of natural gas from Russia in the context of the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline deal. But you see, the thing with Trump, it's like from one thing to another randomly, mixing all issues, mixing trade wars, and acting like a mobster. I mean, this is, you all know Spanish, this is like, it's almost like a shakedown. You would imagine, like, he's expecting Macron and Angela Merkel to come to Brussels with briefcase full of cash. You know, I mean, I'll tell you, I think Donald Trump, when he's out of the White House, should really consider writing a sequel of The Art of the Deal called The Art of the Insult, because, you know, he obviously has an expertise at it. Now,
but you know, the so-called co-author of The Art of the Deal himself has said that Trump did not write that book. He said, and his words were exactly... That Trump can hardly read a book, let alone write one.
Oh, of course not. I know that Trump didn't write that book. He has probably the attention span of a chocolate mouse in the Death Valley in Nevada. So how could he write a book? You know, but before the summit, just to give you an idea of the way fairly reasonable Europeans perceive Trump. The EU Council President Donald Tusk, and he's from Poland, addressed Trump sarcastically over his bullying behavior towards Europe. Tusk wrote, and I'm quoting, "Dear President Trump, America does not have and will not have a better ally than Europe." Tusk also added, "Dear America, appreciate your allies. After all, you don't have that many. And this, you trust, is the problem." I want to give you another idea now of how Trump is perceived in Europe. One of the headlines in yesterday's French paper, Le Figaro, which is a conservative paper, was "Sommet de l'OTAN, l'Europe redoute de la tornade Trump," which translates into "NATO summit, Europe fears the tornado Trump." Tornado, loose cannon. This is what foreign countries have to deal with in regard to the U.S. administration right now. And, you know, it's like the Trump administration is literally like a wild roller coaster ride with constant political mood swings and blatant contradiction from one day to another. It's just, you mentioned to your friend Kim and colleague Kim Ive recently that he was putting some clarity in the confusion. What Trump does day in, day out is put confusion in everything. It's the reign of chaos and confusion. And in terms of policies, including the trade war policies, it's a schizophrenic mixture of isolationist and hegemonist. Trump is absolutely adamant, as you say, that this is a debt. There is no debt from NATO members to the U.S. Absolutely none. You know, it's really incredible. Also, he lies about the level of U.S. contribution. He mentioned that the U.S. contribution is 4% of his GDP. As a matter of fact, the U.S. contribution is 3.14% of the GDP.
Well, in any event, the main thing is that it is only intensifying this propensity of the President of the United States shaming and embarrassing the country, operating as if he runs and he alone runs the entire world. Everybody ought to genuflect before him. And he makes the rules as he sees it. And I'm wondering whether within the European community, is there some kind of resolve that they are not going to submit themselves to the whims of a person who's turning out to be the quintessential example of the ugly American? He may be president, but this is not a presidential way to operate. What signals are you getting that people have had it with this?
I am getting, unfortunately, the position of Angela Merkel right now is weak because of the growing far right in Germany, because it's a coalition and it's weak. Macron is weak. Macron pretend to have the ear of Trump. In reality, nobody has the ear of Trump. There's the issue with Brexit. So there's a lot of problem. Trump would love the EU project to completely collapse. But what we're lacking, this is what we're lacking in Europe. We're lacking real political leadership, like even the one France had during in the Chirac era, and in Germany during the Adenauer era, or even better, during the De Gaulle era in France. This is what's lacking, but it could be if Europe sees the opportunity, it could be an incredible opportunity to take care of this problem here, you know, because the way I see it, you know, the character traits of this U.S. administration, and it's not only Trump, it's his accolades as well, from trade war with allies and foe to geopolitics, it's they really are irrationality, absurdity, and imperiousness. And the way I want to describe it to you, I think that I'm going to make an analogy here, that to contain this sort of mad bull in a China shop, okay, Europe might want to consider shutting down the China shop, which in practice would mean seriously consider a dissolution of NATO, rely for defense on the EU army, and fully operate as a third bloc, and I mean economically, politically, and militarily. In brief, just stop being a vassal of the U.S. and set up a strictly independent course of action. And Trump is giving the EU, if they seize the opportunity, if there's any political will left in the EU, this is the chance.
But, you know, it still will come back to the matter that it was forced to take such drastic action by one person. They are a community of nations, and like any organization, you would find that there are, you know, differences of opinion about just about everything. But to force themselves into an untenable position simply because there's a renegade, there is somebody who's lying straight through his teeth. He does not care about the impact of these lies. He has the world and the compliant media helping him promulgate these lies, saying that the United States is owed so much money. And as I just explained, just read that piece by Robert Burns, who, by the way, is a national security writer for the Associated Press. The truth is there for everybody to see. What is it that Donald Trump continues to dominate? He continues to lie, and he continues to ramrod what he believes ought to be the program, no matter whatever the subject is. he must dominate and control. I think it would be an opportune moment for the European Union nations and for NATO nations to just stand up to the bully and say, hey, but you have to make a decision.
Your choice, that's what you have to do with bullies. You have to stand up and give them a bloody nose from time to time. That's the way you do it with bullies. But your choice. I have to mention for your listeners some very important data here showing that the NATO raison d'être when it started in 1949 was to prevent the dangerous spread of communists from the Soviet. Okay, but the real raison d'être, okay, is really to feed the monstrosity that is the military-industrial complex. You know, the war machine needs enemies. The enemies are very, very seldomly real, and they mostly invented. But it doesn't matter. It's supposed to. So what do we have? The crisis in Syria and Ukraine and this very dangerous Vladimir Putin. But Vladimir Putin was only responding to a provocation. Let me remind your listener of one thing that they probably don't know. Okay, at the collapse when Germany reunified and when Gorbachev. You know, when the Soviet Union was more or less gone, you know, Gorbachev got the verbal promise from George H.W. Bush Sr., the promise that NATO would not expand in what used to be the Warsaw Bloc. Needless to say, this promise, because Trump is not the first U.S. president to lie. They've been doing that for ages. But at least they had a little bit of manners. But Bush Sr. gave promise to Gorbachev, never expand NATO to the former Warsaw Bloc country. And what happened, you know, 30 years later? All those countries are member of NATO, and they are all surrounding Russia. Okay, so this is why now, in 2018, the enemy of choice, and that's kind of thanks to the West, you know, engineering sort of like fake revolution in Syria and Ukraine, for example, is Russia still. But I'll tell you, this is pure propaganda, Western propaganda, because you look at the picture here in terms of military assets, and you have on one side, you have NATO, which is Goliath, and on the other side, you have Russia, which is David. You know, I'm going to give you some number here to show you how ludicrous this anti-Russian hysteria truly is. The NATO forces combined, and those that are from now, 2017, 3.2 million men versus 831,000 for Russia. The nuclear heads that those two blocs have, NATO, 7,065 versus 6,850 for Russia. Nuclear submarine, 22 for NATO with only 13 for Russia. Tanks, 9,857 for NATO, 2,950 for Russia. Fighter jets, NATO has 5,277, while Russia has only 1,065. Aircraft carrier, it's even worse. NATO has 13, Russia has only 1. Now, let's look at the nitty-gritty aspect of it. And of course, it's Donald Trump. Donald Trump only cares about one thing, raw power and money, but mainly money. The budget in 2017 of NATO was $954 billion with a B. That's what NATO sucked in. That's what the industrial military complex sucked in versus 66.3 billion for Russia. And that's not even 8% of NATO overall budget. Now, is it credible to still say and present Russia as a threat to NATO? Seriously. The problem is this, Eucharist.
We'll have to leave it right there, Gilbert, and pick it up, hopefully very, very soon again, because you're making some very salient points that are not normally discussed. We have, as I said, we do not have an independent media here in the United States. They are all basically mouthpieces, and, with only a few exceptions, they are just mimicking and parroting what the Trump administration and the president in his, depending on his mood, you may get four different opinions at the same time. But it has reached a point, and it cannot be ignored, that there's something wrong with the president. Somebody's got to do something, because you can see how easy the transition would be from what he's doing now into causing a global catastrophe. It is not a far stretch.
Quite frankly, I'm just going to say one thing. I'm not a psychiatrist, but my brother is and my mother was. In my brother's opinion, Trump is not competent. As a psychiatrist, he's not competent to be in office.
Well, I think he registers the sentiment of many people, but in the United States, it seems that it is a question, as glaring as it is, nobody really wants to take this on and understand that there are serious implications and consequences to having a president behave this way outside the guidelines that are set for a president. Yes, a president, even a president, has guidelines as to how he or she ought to operate. But Gilbert, a fantastic conversation. Let's continue it, find a way to do so soon. But thank you so much for being with us today.
It's always a pleasure to be on your show.
Thank you. That brings us to the end of the program today. Up next, Global Alert News. Stay tuned for that. And we'll see each other again tomorrow. Bye-bye.